I'm Christopher Leiden, and this is Open Source. This conversation is part of my education in the music of Gustav Mahler. It's with the Nigerian-American novelist Teju Cole in his triumphant debut titled Open City in 2011. Teju Cole built his story to a climactic performance of Mahler's Ninth Symphony in Carnegie Hall. Teju Cole lives and writes in New York. He's a bit of a Mahler obsessive. He tweets often about his favorite composer. I asked him how Mahler entered the mind and the spirit of a young New Yorker who grew up in West Africa.
One simple answer is that he wasn't very much part of my consciousness when I was growing up in Nigeria. What classical music I took in passively. But at the age of 17, I came to the U.S. and started to develop other interests of my own, and I became a pretty avid listener to music and to radio, and I started going to concerts. And I remember in 1994 going on a study abroad visit to Aberdeen, Scotland, and having a chance to listen to, I think it was the London Symphony Orchestra, but there was a performance of Mahler 5, and I'd been listening to a lot of music up to that point, but to listen to this music and see a kind of relationship between how bewildering it is the first time you hear it and how logical and sensible it is by the fifth or sixth or seventh listening. You know, so this idea of something that is complex but then absolutely resolves into becoming part of your own inner logic. And from that point, you know, Mahler just became a very special composer for me. And I think one of my ambitions as somebody in his early 20s, actually, this is giving away some of my secrets. One of my ambitions in my early 20s was to have 3 good recordings of each Mahler symphony. And this was happening at a time when I had really almost no money at all. But I like almost all of his music, but the late symphonies then became really, really important. And certain performances I saw of Mahler 9 then became very special for me. In a way, he's an American composer for me.
Yeah, tell us.
You know, in a way that Ravel is also an American composer, and Dvořák is an American composer. Composers who took advantage of modern travel and came to this country and did tours or conducted here and became an important part of musical life here. So that when you hear their music in this country, you kind of connect them to past American listeners who connected to them in a very direct way. So Mahler is an American composer in the way that Leonard Bernstein is an American composer. And Bernstein, of course, then becomes the big Mahler champion. I don't know, it's certainly not paranoia, but there's a sense of everything is connected that appeals to me. As a creative person, the idea that things can talk to each other and connect to each other in a way that the weave of existence is tight. I don't know. It's something that very much connects to my sensibility.
Teju, when you listen to Mahler 9, take us on the walk that your head goes through from that very, very slow and quiet and minimalist beginning up the mountain and down to the sort of vanishing end.
Why does he connect to us in a way that, let's say, Wagner does not?
Yeah, interesting.
I think part of what is happening is that Mahler, in his own self, was not in the mainstream of things. There's this, he's Jewish, he's neurotic, and there's a way he's not representing the dominant culture. He's not making music about the central German myths. In a sort of modernist way that we can relate to, he is making it autobiographical. And that kind of makes a kind of sense to us, you know. And meanwhile, someone like Wagner is saying, well, these are the great myths of our people, and Wagner's power is of a different kind. When you're sitting watching an orchestra and there's this silence after the tuning, you're looking at these vast forces sitting on the stage. Yeah. And the way the symphony begins, and I say all of this as somebody who's not a musician, just a great lover of this music, the way it begins, it does feel as, I mean, the reason the metaphor of a ship leaving the port comes to me is because these vast forces start out with this very soft and hesitant sound. You know that the orchestra can make sounds much louder than that. Mm-hmm. But it just sort of starts out with this sighing, this back and forth figure. Something sort of sliding away. What becomes this falling figure then becomes what the entire first movement, and in fact the whole symphony, is built on. So you start this sort of very gentle journey, and then, you know, as with Mahler, before too long it gets more and more complicated, and he now shows you the real size of this ship. You know, I mean, everybody gets involved. Different instrument groups carry different versions of this figure, and you have this incredible complexity. But you don't forget that the core of it is essentially simple, almost as if it's saying, you know, life, death, and that every complication comes out of this binary. The two middle movements, again, I'm not a musicologist, but they seem to me to just remind us that no matter what happened, that Mahler was someone like Bartok, like Brahms, for whom folk music was at the very heart of the enterprise. There are these Ländler type of musical figures, this traditional Austrian music that show up with great frequency in his work. Maybe a more contemporary sensibility would have said, I'm doing a piece of music that is about the most profound things, and so that profundity has to be the tone all through. But for someone like Mahler, there was this sense of always interrupting the music with more folkloric elements, with more parodic, more satirical elements, more fast-paced things going on. And I think that was important so that when we return to the very somber figures that open the final movement, it feels earned in some way. And, you know, and of course that final movement is one of the monuments of the musical literature. It sort of starts out with something that sounds a lot like Abide With Me. So there's something consoling about it. But then it goes into these spaces that really start to open out. And this is 1909, but, you know, I'm hearing all kinds of things that sound like Schoenberg and all the things that come with that, you know. So there's something kind of prophetic about it. Mahler himself dies in a couple of years. But Europe completely convulses itself 5 or 6 years after this music is written and has to find new ways of making meaning. But the final movement of the ninth seems to be pushing towards a simplicity, pushing towards a tonality in a way that feels prophetic, and in a way that seems to talk even now to our predicament of making sense of modernity. The word I end up coming back to is consolation. I feel that this is music that consoles, that says that even the title of Lewis Thomas's lovely brooding meditation, Late Night Thoughts on Listening to Mahler's Ninth, yes, if I have it exact,
yes,
even that title is a consolation, because we know exactly what that feels like, to have music going through you in the still small hours of the night and telling you that there is more to the world than its apparent disorder. I mean, that book, which was brooding on questions of nuclear mutual annihilation, there's a way in which, from our vantage point, when we're thinking about potentially cataclysmic climate change or potentially cataclysmic wealth inequality, I mean, one of those two things is going to get us eventually. You listen to something like Mahler 9, and this is one of those things in the culture that can serve as a consolation.
Where are you at the end? I mean, we've been through as close as art can give us to the experience of death. Where's Memento Jucol?
At the end?
Yeah.
Well, usually it ends and you're just hoping that everybody who's listening with you and just hold that space. This music has died out. I mean, it doesn't end with a bang. It dies out reluctantly, like one's last breath. And you just want everyone to hold that moment with you. Give it a few seconds, whether you are in Jordan Hall or in Carnegie Hall or in Symphony Hall or, you know, at the Philharmonic in Berlin. You just want to be with that crowd in absolute silence so that you can all experience this together. You hope it's not one of those nights where there's some guy who's so eager to start clapping. So that's where I am at the end, which you get nowhere else in the culture, by the way, where you have a crowd who has not been instructed, who are all willingly being quiet for a few moments.
Let me ask you, Teju, as a novelist who does symphonies, I said to Ben Zander last night after the rehearsal, I read novels all the time. I've never read a novel remotely as complicated, as detailed, whose architecture is so both incredibly important but also obscure as this Mahler 9. The fortes, the pianissimos, the horns, the woodwinds, the voices, the plots, the subplots, and the incredible simplicity of that whole tone movement. How does a novelist hear this? What's the connection to be made or not made in the construction of these monsters?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll tell you that, Kieslowski, who's a filmmaker I love very much, you know, ostensibly gave up filmmaking not long before he died, but he basically gave up filmmaking after doing his Three Colors Red. He finished that trilogy, and part of his frustration was that films could not quite achieve the complexity that that novels could. Mm-hmm. For me as a novelist, I look at great symphonies and great suites of music with terrific envy. You know, how does a novelist sit down and write something that can, I mean, let's be serious, that can equal Brahms 4, or that can equal, you know, the Sibelius 7, or Mahler 5, or Mahler 9, or Mahler 1, for that matter. Mm. So I look at these things from the point of view of great envy. Suddenly, when I sit down to write, I'm thinking about great pieces of music that take you to all sorts of places emotionally and just feel complete without you having to worry about the plot, because the spaces they take you are psychological. You know, Schubert's great string quintet or Kind of Blue, things that are complete from beginning to end, but they're psychologically complete. So that's for me as a novelist, that's what I think about when I listen to Mahler 9. I just think, well, it's too bad it's so difficult in my chosen field to reach this kind of complexity and completeness. But then again, I'm sure most composers feel the same way too.
Did you call your wonderful gift in conversation, in your novel Open City, is this business about looking out your window, walking through the streets of New York and seeing the past, seeing the layers in front of your eyes. And Mahler is one of them for you. A word or two about sort of where you see, hear, feel Mahler in your New York today.
Well, this was his city as well. So in every musical encounter in this city, there's sort of that personal memory of this man was also here with us. Mm. His picture is up at Avery Fisher Hall, his picture is up at Carnegie Hall. He's present in that way. He has been an influential composer, you know. I think his work is present in anybody who's still writing for large orchestra, whether it's, you know, Philip Glass or John Adams or any of our contemporary Goliov, any of our contemporary composers.
John Williams in all those Spielberg movies.
For sure, you know, in our film music. I mean, how many film scores have been birthed by, you know, the Adagietto from Mahler 5. It was sort of the original, you know, orchestral musical interlude. But he's also present in the way he was a great scholar of music. He was an open-minded consumer of the musical past. He was a great conductor of music, possibly the first great composer for whom we have ironclad evidence that he was also a great conductor. And so he knew many other people's music. so that there's a way in which when you're listening to a quite complicated late Beethoven, or you're listening to a devilish fugue by Bach, you also think of Mahler, because he used all these techniques as well. He's omnipresent in a way. He's an important American composer, an important Viennese composer, an important New York City composer. But he's also just a great, I think, private joy for the people who like his music, you know.
Yeah. I was thinking of the subways, the canyons, the sky, day, night in New York. Do you hear him?
Well, I mean, that's one analogy I try to draw in my book, and that I try to draw on, which is this idea that when something is shadowed, it's not just black in an undifferentiated way, but that there are places where the light then shoots through. And when something is bright, there are moments of shadow. And the architecture of our city makes us understand that, you know. The clouds are racing overhead, and you've got this sort of sharp distinctions of brightly lit streets and shadowed streets, you know, in late afternoon in Manhattan, for example. And that music is very much like that. There's actually no movement that doesn't have its happy bits and its melancholy bits and its massive and loud beats bits and it's very quiet and intimate. This natural instinct for montage makes sense to the environments we function in. Life cannot be just one thing or another. You know, there was something about Mahler that, and I, now these days, I can't quite remember if, did I read this somewhere? Am I making it up? But in any way, it's a story I love and I often hold on to, which was that, you know, his parents were having a terrific argument when he was a little boy. And, you know, and he was so distressed by this, he dashed out of the house and he went out into the street. And along came a man playing the hurdy-gurdy. And that this became a kind of example to him that the sublime and the ridiculous are always interspersed with each other in life, which is why the second movement of Mahler 9 is important. You know, I mean, suddenly, why are peasants dancing, you know, in the middle of this profound music? Because that's precisely how life is. You're at the funeral, and then the next moment, someone is dancing.
Teju Cole, thank you so much for your work, for this conversation, for everything.
Such a pleasure to talk about this stuff, and it's always good to talk to you, Chris. Thank you very much.